As we watched, the turbid's surface rippled unwillingly, and rippled again, and a strange unearthly creature emerged, a creature also red, heavily armored, and with remarkable joints. It groaned as if tired and dispirited, and reaching the red sand, it flopped down by the side of the tideless sea. Above our heads a red sun glowed dully, casting fearful, blood-red shadows, harsh and garish. About us there was no movement, no sign of life other than the strange shelled creatures which lay half-dead on the ground. Even though I was in the astral body, I shivered in apprehension as I gazed about me. A red sea upon which floated red scum, red rocks, red sand, red shelled creatures, and above all a red sun like the dying embers of a fire which was about to flicker into nothingness. The Lama Miniadon up said, "This is a dying world. There is no longer rotation here. This world floats derelict in the sea of space, a satellite to a dying sun, which is soon to collapse, and thus to become a dwarf star without life, without light, a dwarf star which eventually will collide with another star, and from those another world shall be born. I have brought you here because yet in this world there is life of a high order, a life which is here for research and investigation of phenomena of this sort. Look about you." He turned and pointed with his right hand to the far distance, and we saw three immense towers reaching up into the red, red sky, and on the very top of those towers three gleaming crystal balls glowed and pulsated with clear, yellow light, as if they were alive. As we stood there wondering, one of the lights changed, one of the spheres turned a vivid electric blue. The Lama Miniadon up said, "Come, they are bidding us welcome. Let us descend into the ground to where they are living in an underground chamber." Together we moved towards the base of that tower, and then, as we stood beneath the framework, we saw there was an entrance heavily secured with some strange metal which glimmered and stood out like a scar upon that red and barren land. We moved through it, for metal, or rocks, or anything is no bar to those in the astral. We moved through and traversed long red corridors of dead rock until at last we stood in a very large hall, a hall surrounded by charts and maps, and strange machines and instruments. In the center there was a long table at which sat nine very aged men, all unlike each other. One was tall and thin, and with a pointed head, a conical head. Yet another was short and very solid looking. Each of these men was different. It was clear to us that each man was of a different planet, of a different race. Human? Well, perhaps humanoid would be a better word with which to describe them. They were all human, but some were more human than others. We became aware that all nine were looking fixedly in our direction. "Ah," said one telepathically, "we have visitors from afar. We saw you land upon this, our research station, and we bid you welcome." "Respected fathers," said the Lama Miniadon up, "I have brought to you two who have just entered upon the state of lamahood and who are earnest students in search of knowledge." "They are indeed welcome," said the tall man, who was apparently the leader of the group. "We will do anything to help as we have helped you with others previously." This was indeed news to me, because I had no idea that my guide did such extensive astral traveling through celestial places. The shorter man was looking at me, and smiled. He said in the universal language of telepathy, "I see, young man, that you are greatly intrigued by the difference in our appearances." "Respected father," I replied, somewhat overawed by the ease with which he had divined my thoughts, thoughts which I had tried hard to conceal. "That is indeed a fact. I marvel at the disparity of sizes and shapes between you, and it occurred to me that you could not all be men of Earth." "You have perceived correctly," said the short man. "We are all human, but due to environment we have altered our shapes and our stature somewhat. But can you not see the same thing on your own planet, where upon the land of Tibet there are some monks whom you employ as guards who are 7 feet tall? Yet upon another country of that world, you have people who are but half that stature, and you call them pygmies. They are both human, they are both able to reproduce each with the other, notwithstanding any difference in size, for we are all humans of carbon molecules. Here in this particular universe everything depends upon the basic molecules of carbon and hydrogen, for these two are the bricks composing the structure of your universe. We who have traveled in other universes far beyond this particular branch of our nebulae know that other universes use different bricks. Some use silicon, some use gypsum, some use other things, but they are different from people of this universe, and we find to our sorrow that our thoughts are not always in affinity with them. The Lama Minyadon Up said, I have brought these two young lamas here so that they can see the stages of death and decay in a planet which has exhausted its atmosphere, and in which the oxygen of that atmosphere has combined with metals to burn them and to reduce everything to an impalpable dust. That is so, said the tall man. We would like to point out to these young men that everything that is born must die. Everything lives for its allotted span, and that allotted span is a number of units of life. A unit of life in any living creature is a heartbeat of that creature. The life of a planet is 2,700,000,000 heartbeats, after which the planet dies, but from the death of a planet others are born. A human, too, lives for 2,700,000,000 heartbeats, and so does the lowliest insect. An insect which lives for but 24 hours has, during that time, have 2,700,000,000 heartbeats. A planet, they vary, of course, but one planet may have one heartbeat in 27,000 years, and after that there will be a convulsion upon that world as it shakes itself ready for the next heartbeat. All life, then, he went on, has the same span, but some creatures live at rates different from those of others. Creatures upon Earth, the elephant, the tortoise, the ant and the dog, they all live for the same number of heartbeats, but all have hearts beating at different speeds, and thus they may appear to live longer or to live less. Jigme and I found this extremely enthralling, and it explained so much to us that we had perceived upon our native land of Tibet. We had heard in the Potali about the tortoise which lives for so many years, and about the insect which lived for but a summer's evening. Now we could see that their perceptions must have been speeded up to keep pace with their speeding hearts. The short man who seemed to look upon us with considerable approval, said, yes, not only that, but many animals represent different functions of the body. The cow, for instance, as anyone can see, is merely a walking mammary gland, the giraffe is a neck, a dog, well, anyone knows what a dog is always thinking of, sniffing the wind for news as his sight is so poor, and so a dog can be regarded as a nose. Other animals have similar affinities to different parts of one's anatomy. The anteater of South America could be looked upon as a tongue. For some time we talked telepathically, learning many strange things, learning with the speed of thought as one does in the astral. Then at last the Lama Minyadon Up stood up and said it was time to leave. Beneath us as we returned the golden roofs of the Potala gleamed in the frosty sunlight. Our bodies were stiff, heavy and difficult to work with their half-frozen joints. And so, we thought, as we stumble to our feet, another experience, another journey has ended. What next? A science at which we Tibetans excelled was healing by herbs. Always, until now, Tibet has been shut off from foreigners, and our fauna and flora have never been explored by the foreigners. On the high plateaus grow strange plants. Curare, and the recently discovered mescaline, for instance, were known in Tibet centuries ago. We could cure many of the afflictions of the Western world. But first the people of the Western world would have to have a little more faith. But most of the Westerners are mad anyway, so why bother? Every year parties of us, those who had done best at their studies went on herb-gathering expeditions. Plants and pollens, roots and seeds, were carefully gathered, treated, and stored in yak hide sacks. I loved the work and studied well. Now I find that the herbs I knew so well cannot be obtained here. Eventually I was considered fit to take the ceremony of the little death, which I wrote about in the third eye. By special rituals I was placed in a state of cataleptic death, far beneath the Potala, and I journeyed into the past, along the Akashic record. I journeyed, too, to the lands of the earth. But let me write it as it felt to me then. The corridor in the living rock hundreds of feet beneath the frozen earth was dank, dank and dark with the darkness of the tomb itself. I moved along its length drifting like smoke in the blackness, and with increasing familiarity with that blackness I perceived at first indistinctly the greenish phosphorescence of mouldering vegetation clinging to the rock walls. Occasionally where the vegetation was most prolific and the light the brightest I could catch a yellow gleam from the gold vein running the length of this rocky tunnel. I drifted along soundlessly without consciousness of time, without thought of anything except that I must go farther and farther into the interior of the earth, for this was a day which was momentous to me, a day when I was returning from 3 days in the astral state. Time passed and I found myself deeper, deeper in the subterranean chamber in increasing blackness, a blackness which seemed to sound, a blackness which seemed to vibrate. In my imagination I could picture the world above me, the world to which I was now returning. I could visualize the familiar scene now hidden by total darkness. I waited, poised in the air like a cloud of incense smoke in a temple. Gradually, so slowly that it was some time before I could even perceive it, a sound came down the corridor, the vaguest of sounds, but gradually swelling and increasing in intensity. The sound of chanting, the sound of silver bells, and the muffled shush-shush of leather-bound feet. At last, at long last, an eerie wavering light appeared glistening along the walls of the tunnel. The sound was becoming louder now. I waited poised above a rock slab in the darkness. I waited. Gradually, oh so gradually, so painfully slowly, moving figures crept cautiously down the tunnel towards me. As they came closer I saw that they were yellow-robed monks bearing aloft glaring torches, precious torches from the temple above with rare resin woods and incense sticks bound together giving a fragrant scent to drive away the odors of death and of decay. Bright lights to dim and make invisible the evil glow of the rank vegetation. Slowly the priests entered the underground chamber. To move to each of the walls near the entrance and fumbled on the rocky ledges. Then one after the other flickering butter lamps sprang into life. Now the chamber was more illuminated and I could look about me once again and see as I had not seen for 3 days. The priests stood around me and saw me not, they stood around a stone tomb resting in the center of the chamber. The chanting increased, and the ringing of the silver bells too. At last, at a signal given by an old man, 6 monks stopped and panting and grunting lifted the stone lid off the coffin. Inside as I looked down I saw my own body, a body clad in the robes of a priest of the Lama class. The monks were chanting louder now, singing, O spirit of the visiting Lama, wandering the face of the world above, return for this, the third day, has come and is about to pass. A first stick of incense is lit to recall the spirit of the visiting Lama. A monk stood forth and lit a stick of sweet-smelling incense, red in color, and then took another from a box as the priests chanted, O spirit of the visiting Lama, returning here to us, hasten for the hour of your awakening draws nigh. A second stick of incense is lit to hasten your return. As the monks solemnly drew a stick of incense from the box, the priest recited, O spirit of the visiting Lama, we await to reanimate and nourish your earthly body. Speed you on your way for the hour is at hand, and with your return here another grade in your education will have been passed. A third stick of incense is lit at the call of returning. As the smoke swirled lazily upwards engulfing my astral form, I shivered in dread. It was as if invisible hands were drawing me, as if hands were drawing on my silver cord, drawing me down, reeling me in, forcing me into that cold, lifeless body. I felt the coldness of death. I felt shivering in my limbs, I felt my astral sight grow dim, and then great gasps racked my body which trembled uncontrollably. High priests bent down into the stone tomb, lifted my head and my shoulders and forced something bitter between my tightly clenched jaws. Ah, I thought, back in the confining body again, back in the confining body. It seemed as if fire was coursing through my veins, veins which had been dormant for 3 days. Gradually the priest seized me out of the tomb, supporting me, lifting me, keeping me on my feet, walking me around in the stone chamber, kneeling before me, prostrating themselves at my feet, reciting their mantras, saying their prayers, and lighting their sticks of incense. They forced nourishment into me, washed me and dried me, and changed my robes. With consciousness returning into the body, For some strange reason, my thoughts wandered back to the time 3 days before when a similar occurrence had taken place. Then I had been laid down in this selfsame stone coffin. One by one the llamas had looked at me. Then they had put the lid upon the stone coffin and extinguished the sticks of incense. Solemnly they had departed up the stone corridor, bearing their lights with them, while I lay quite a little frightened in that stone tomb, frightened in spite of all my training, frightened in spite of knowing what was to happen. I had been long in the darkness, in the silence of death. Silence? No, for my perceptions had been trained, and were so acute that I could hear their breathing, sounds of life diminishing as they went away. I could hear the shuffling of their feet growing fainter and fainter, and then darkness, silence, and stillness, and nothingness. Death itself could not be worse than this, I thought. Time crawled endlessly by as I lay there becoming colder and colder. All of a sudden the world exploded as in a golden flame, and I left the confines of the body, I left the blackness of the stone tomb, and the underground chamber. I forced my way through the earth, the ice-bound earth, and into the cold pure air, and away far above the towering Himalayas, far out over the land and oceans, far away to the ends of the earth with the speed of thought. I wandered alone, ethereal, ghost-like in the astral, seeking out the places and palaces of the earth, gaining education by watching others. Not even the most secret vaults were sealed to me, for I could wander as free as a thought to enter the council chambers of the world. The leaders of all lands passed before me in constant panorama, their thoughts naked to my probing eye. And now, I thought, as dizzily I stumbled to my feet supported by llamas, now I have to report all that I saw, all that I experienced, and then? Perhaps soon I shall have another similar experience to undergo. After that I shall have to journey into the Western world, to endure the hardship forecast. With much training behind me, and much hardship too, I set out from Tibet to more training, and much more hardship. As I looked back, before crossing the Himalayas, I saw the early rays of the sun, peeping over the mountain ranges, touching the golden roofs of the sacred buildings and turning them into visions of breathtaking delight. The valley of Lhasa seemed still asleep, and even the prayer flags nodded drowsily at their masts. By the Pagokling I could just discern a yak train, the traders, early risers like me, setting out for India while I turned towards Chongqing. Over the mountain ranges we went, taking the paths trodden by the traders bringing tea into Tibet, bricks of tea from China, tea which with tsampa was one of the staple foods eaten by Tibetans. 1927 it was when we left Lhasa, and made our way to Chittang, a little town on the river Brahmaputra. On we went to Kanting, down into the lowlands, through lush forests, through valleys steaming with dank vegetation, on we went suffering with our breathing, because we, all of us, were used to breathing air only at 15,000 feet or higher. The lowlands with their heavy atmosphere pressing upon us depressed our spirits, compressing our lungs, making us feel that we were drowning in air. On we went day after day, until after 1,000 miles or more we reached the outskirts of the Chinese city of Chongqing. Encamped for the night, our last night together, for on the morrow my companions would set off on the return journey to our beloved Lhasa, encamped together, we talked mournfully. It distressed me considerably that my comrades, my retainers, were already treating me as a person dead to the world, as a person condemned to live in the lowland cities. And so on the morrow I went to the University of Chongqing, a university where almost all the professors, almost all the staff worked hard to ensure the success of the students, to help in any way possible, and only the very minute minority were difficult or uncooperative, or suffered from xenophobia. In Chongqing I studied to be a surgeon and a physician. I studied also to be an air pilot, for my life was mapped out, foretold in minutest detail, and I knew, as proved to be the case, that later I would do much in the air and in medicine. But in Chongqing there were still only the mutterings of war to come and most of the people in this, an ancient and modern city combined, lived day by day enjoying their ordinary happiness, doing their ordinary tasks. This was my first visit in the physical to one of the major cities, my first visit, in fact, to any city outside Lhasa, Although in the astral form I had visited most of the great cities of the world, as anyone can if they will practice, for there is nothing difficult, nothing magical in the astral, it is as easy as walking, easier than riding a bicycle because on a bicycle one has to balance, in the astral one has merely to use the abilities and faculties which our birthright gave us. While I was still studying at the University of Chongqing, I was summoned back to Lhasa because the 13th Dalai Lama was about to die. I arrived there and took part in the ceremonies which followed his death, and then after attending to various business in Lhasa I again returned to Chongqing. At a later interview with the Supreme Abbot, Taishu, I was persuaded to accept a commission in the Chinese Air Force, and to go to Shanghai, a place which although I knew I had to visit had no attraction whatever for me. So once again I was uprooted and made my way to another home. Here on July 7, 1937, the Japanese staged an incident at the Marco Polo Bridge. This was the actual starting point of the China-Japanese War, and it made things very difficult indeed for us. I had to leave my quite lucrative practice in Shanghai and place myself at the disposal of the Shanghai Municipal Council for a time, but afterwards I devoted all my time to mercy flying for the Chinese forces. I and others flew to places where there was a great need of urgent surgery. We flew in old aircraft which were actually condemned for anything else but which were considered good enough for those who were not fighting but patching up bodies. I was captured by the Japanese, after being shot down, and they treated me quite roughly. I did not look like a Chinaman, they did not quite know what I looked like, and so because of my uniform, because of my rank, they were thoroughly unpleasant. I managed to escape and made my way back to the Chinese forces in the hope of continuing with my work. First I was sent to Chongqing to have a change of scene before returning to active duty. Chongqing was then a different place from the Chongqing which I had known before. The buildings were new, or rather some of the old buildings had new fronts because the place had been bombed. The place was absolutely crowded and all types of businesses from the major cities of China were now congregating in Chongqing in the hopes of escaping the devastation of the war which was raging elsewhere. After recovering somewhat I was sent down to the coast under the command of General Liu. I was appointed as medical officer in charge of the hospital, but the hospital was merely a collection of paddy fields which were thoroughly waterlogged. The Japanese soon came along and captured us and killed all those patients who were unable to rise and walk. I was taken off again and treated remarkably badly because the Japanese recognized me as one who had escaped before, and they really did not like people who escape. After some time I was sent to be prison medical officer in charge of a prison camp for women of all nationalities. There, due to my specialized training in herbs, I was able to make the best use of the natural resources of the camp to treat patients who otherwise would have been denied all medication. The Japanese thought that I was doing too much for the prisoners and not letting them die enough, and so they sent me to a prison camp in Japan, a camp which they said was for terrorists. I was herded across the Sea of Japan in a leaky ship and we were very badly treated indeed. I was badly tortured by them, and their continual torture gave me pneumonia. They did not want me to die and so in their way they looked after me, and gave me treatment. When I was recovering, I did not let the Japanese know how well I was recovering. The earth shook, I thought it was an earthquake, and then I looked out of the window and found that the Japanese were running in terror, and all the sky turned red, it looked as if the sun was obscured. Although I did not know it, this was the atom bombing of Hiroshima. The day of the first bomb on August 6, 1945, the Japanese had no time for me, they needed all their time to look after themselves, I thought, and so I managed to pick up a uniform, a cap, and a pair of heavy sandals. Then I trotted out into the open air through the narrow unguarded doorway, and managed to make my way down to the shore where I found a fishing boat. Apparently the owner had fled in terror as the bomb dropped, for he was nowhere in sight. The boat idly rocked at its moorings. In the bottom there were a few pieces of stale fish already starting to give off the odor of decay. There was a discarded can nearby which had stale water in it, drinkable, but only just. I managed to hack away the flimsy rope holding the boat to the shore, and cast off. The wind filled out the ragged sail when I managed to hoist it hours later, and the boat headed out into the unknown. The effort was too much for me. I just toppled to the bottom in a dead faint. A long time after, how long I cannot say, I can only judge the passage of time by the state of decomposition of the fish, I awakened to the dimness of a dawn. The boat was racing on, the little waves breaking over the bows. I was too ill with pneumonia to bail, and so I just had to lie with my shoulders and the bottom of my body in the salt water, in all the refuse which swirled about. Later in the day the sun came out with blinding power. I felt as if my brains were being boiled in my head, as if my eyes were being burned out. I felt as if my tongue was growing to be the size of my arm, dry, aching. My lips and my cheeks were cracked. The pain was too much for me. I felt that my lungs are bursting again, and I knew that once more pneumonia had attacked both lungs. The light of the day faded from me, and I sank back into the bilge water, unconscious. Time had no meaning, time was just a series of red blurs, punctuated by darkness. Pain raged through me and I hovered at the border between life and death. Suddenly there was a violent jolt, and the screech of pebbles beneath the keel. The mast swayed as if it would snap, and the tattered rag of a sail fluttered madly in the stiff breeze. I slid forward in the bottom of the boat, unconscious amid the stinking, swirling water. Gee, Hank, dees a gook in the bottom of the boat, sure looks like a stiff to me. The nasal voice roused me to a flicker of consciousness. I lay there, unable to move, unable to show that I was still alive. Wat zamada widya? Scared of a corpse. We want da boat, don't we? Give me a hand and we toss him out. Heavy footsteps rocked the boat, and threatened to crush my head. Man oh man, said the first voice, dat poor guy he sure took a beating from exposure. Mab he still breathes, Hank, what ya think? Or, stop belly arkin. He's good as dead. Toss him out. We got no time to waste. Strong, harsh hands grabbed me by the feet and head. I was swung once, twice, and then let go and I sailed over the side of the boat to fall with a bone-rattling crash onto a pebble and sand beach. Without a backward glance, the two men heaved and strained at the stranded boat. Grunting and cursing they labored, throwing aside small rocks and stones. At last the boat broke free and with a grating scrunch floated slowly backwards into the water. In a panic, for some reason unknown to me, the two men scrambled frenziedly aboard and went off in a series of clumsy tacks. The sun blazed on. Small creatures in the sound bit me, and I suffered the tortures of the damned. Gradually the day wore out, until at last the sun set, blood red and threatening. Water lapped at my feet, crept up to my knees. Huh. With stupendous effort I crawled a few feet, digging my elbows into the sand, wriggling, struggling. Then oblivion. Hours later, or it may have been days, I awakened to find the sunlight streaming in upon me. Shakily I turned my head and looked about. The surroundings were wholly unfamiliar. I was in a small one-roomed cottage, with sea sparkling and glistening in the distance. As I turned my head I saw an old Buddhist priest watching me. He smiled and came towards me, sitting on the floor by my side. Haltingly, and with some considerable difficulty, we conversed. Our languages were similar but not identical, and with much effort, substituting and repeating words, we discussed the position. For some time, the priest said, I have known that I would have a visitor of some eminence, one who had a great task in life. Although old, I have lingered on until my task was completed. The room was very poor, very clean, and the old priest was obviously on the verge of starvation. He was emaciated and his hands shook with weakness and age. His faded, ancient robe was patterned with neat stitches where he had repaired the ravages of age and accidents. We saw you thrown from the boat, he said. For long we thought you were dead and we could not get to the beach to make sure because of marauding bandits. At nightfall two men of the village went out and brought you here to me. But that was 5 days ago, you have been very ill indeed. We know that you will live to journey afar and life will be hard. Hard. Why did everyone tell me so often that life would be hard? Did they think I liked it? Definitely it was hard, always had been, and I hated hardship as much as anyone. This is Najin, the priest continued. We are on the outskirts. As soon as you are able, you will have to leave, for my own death is near. For 2 days I moved carefully around, trying to regain my strength, trying to pick up the threads of life again. I was weak, starved, and almost beyond caring whether I lived or died. A few old friends of the priest came to see me and suggested what I should do, and how I should travel. On the third morning as I awakened, I saw the old priest lying stiff and cold beside me.